This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Bill Dorman in today for Catherine Cruz. This past spring, a 40-person group of Hawaii state lawmakers, economists, and business people headed from the islands to Hong Kong and to Singapore. They were looking for answers about housing and transportation infrastructure. Given what happened in Hong Kong since then, it seems like nearly another age. Street protests in Hong Kong started against a proposed extradition treaty to China. That proposal was shelved. The protests continued and expanded, though, to a broader movement that swelled in numbers and intensity. We wanted to get some perspective on Hong Kong this morning, and we didn't have to go too far. Richard Volsek is the president of the East-West Center here in Honolulu, and before taking up that position about 2.5 years ago, was president of the American Chamber of Commerce in Hong Kong from February 2008 through December 2016. Richard, thanks for joining us this morning.
Good to be back. Thank you.
What's your sense about how dangerous the situation is right now in Hong Kong? Can this be resolved without the use of force?
Well, dangerous in a couple ways to look at it. Physically, personally dangerous. If you turn a wrong corner and you find yourself in a police tear gas barrage, that's probably dangerous. It is a bit localized, though, similar to the Umbrella Revolution. It's not just all in one locale, even though there's some central locations for the major protests, as you would imagine, around the city government offices and the liaison office government. But they popped up in Mong Kok on the other side and Kowloon side and so forth. Now this one's gone to the airport. So it could be dangerous. I mean, I think the United States has a warning out to be careful about avoiding demonstration areas. Of course, it's getting increasingly difficult to do that, so one of the main demonstration areas is the airport.
Yes.
So it makes it a bit complicated. But Hong Kong demonstrators are really, for the most part, I think, really, really disciplined. The difficulty has been, as in the Umbrella Revolution, and we saw reports of this in Hong Kong, that the triads get involved a bit too, for whatever reason, and they're the ones that instigate, I think, some of the more... diligent fisticuffs, I guess, that leads to a more dangerous situation. Yeah. Common sense is the way to go, I think. Yeah. My guess, like the Umbrella Revolution, when we had to walk through on the edges of protest areas, we found the people very disciplined and easy to interact with if we had to.
And Hong Kong, historically, I mean, freedom of expression is such a basic part. And the demonstrations, you mentioned the Umbrella Revolution, even before that, in terms of the most gripping markings of the Tiananmen Square anniversaries are in Hong Kong. This is a place that is used to demonstrations, protests, freedom of expression.
Absolutely. In fact, it's not a stretch to say it's a core value for Hong Kongers.
And that idea, I think for some friends in Hong Kong, this is what is most disturbing to them, that the feel of that under threat. Do you sense that feeling?
Well, you know, back in 1997, when Hong Kong reverted to mainland China through the one country, two systems formula, meaning that foreign affairs and so forth were handled, and foreign policy would be handled by China, otherwise it's the Special Administrative Region, SAR. Ran its own affairs. And there are a lot of media things. You remember for yourself, the death of Hong Kong and all that sort of thing as major magazine cover articles and so forth. Well, that didn't happen. And then in the last 4 or 5 years, there's been more concern that 97 fears are rearing its ugly head again. And one of the things the chamber always talked about in our interactions with both the Chinese government and the Hong Kong SAR government was that the rule of law was really the transparency, freedom of speech, and so forth, ethical business and governmental practices were kind of core values for the international community and actually our impression for the Hong Kong business community as well. So the canary in the minefield for early warning of problems was really rule of law. Hong Kong still has a Court of Appeals, for example, attracts the best international jurists, mainly from Britain, to come to Hong Kong to adjudicate cases. One sign we said if they stopped coming, that would be a sign that rule of law was under threat. Well, here we see with the current activity that the big divide in Hong Kong is a, you know, international Western rule of law,
right,
where no one is above the law, whereas in China it's rule by law, which means the party's in charge, and of course the party chairman is in charge of the party. And so you use law or don't use it as you see fit for political ends adjudicated by the party. It's a big difference. So the extradition law, where you could snatch somebody from Hong Kong and try them in Chinese courts, mm-hmm, is a big issue for Hong Kongers,
yeah,
because it's not the same system.
You know, you mentioned the business perspective. One of the sort of the side threads of this within one of the demonstrations, one of the demonstrators was a pilot for Cathay Pacific, long-standing company, part of Swire Group. At any rate, this eventually led to pressure for senior executives to resign. What's your take on how significant that is and how you see that?
Frankly, I think that's almost more significant than the
demonstrations
from a business point of view. To have a publicly listed company have China force senior executives to resign, and then to do all these for flight attendants to have their phones confiscated and searched, and some things lifted and put on public on social media. I mean, the freedom of speech, freedom of expression, again, at the core of Hong Kong and business values. Here we got a company based in Hong Kong. It's having those restrictions, those freedoms restricted heavily. And if they can do it to Cathay Pacific, they can do it to anybody.
And clearly this message has come through, because you see then public pronouncements from Jardine Matheson, from other companies based in Hong Kong, that condemnation of violence within protests, but careful wording, I suppose, mm-hmm, you could say.
Well, but when you're telling your employees, you don't have to tell them, they can see it for themselves, that they can't post things to their friends or they're based in Hong Kong, it's dangerous. They can't appear near a demonstration, that's
right,
dangerous. Those are really basic rights in the Hong Kong DNA that are being violated. And from the business point of view, you have basically a quick shift to working in Hong Kong is the same as working in Shanghai.
Right.
And businesses will still do that, but they'll operate very, very differently. And the international status of Hong Kong as a global financial center is going to suffer.
You know, that international comparison, because for years it would be Hong Kong and Singapore in terms of international, multinational companies, where's your Asia-Pacific base? And now that takes on a bit of a different perspective.
It does. It's still a spectrum, because, you know,
sure,
Singapore has controlled the press a lot too, mm-hmm, and fairly draconian approaches to protests and so on. So it's a spectrum. So each place has advantages and disadvantages. And that's one thing that businesses, depending on what they do and how they operate, are going to have to reevaluate their own operational standards and expectations, and really we have a lot of work to do with their staff and employees to make sure that people are clear about what the company concerns are in this new environment.
And meanwhile, you've got an economic environment in Hong Kong where Morgan Stanley's predicting a recession. There are a lot of the banks are looking at shrinking business, and you have sort of the pressure, not only the demonstrations, but you have a slowing Chinese economy, you have trade tensions in terms of the U.S.-China and the knock-on effects on Hong Kong. When you look at the business situation in Hong Kong, what do you see?
Well, I think, you know, businesses, in my experience when I was there running AmCham, was most of them have these kind of crisis planning, mm-hmm, things on the shelf anyway. Certainly since the Umbrella Revolution, there's been some experience added to the memory banks and so forth. I'm fairly confident that the businesses will see a way. They're not just going to go belly up because of a couple months of demonstrations. But there'll be operational differences for sure. And then some real evaluation on where to have operations centered, perhaps in some certain operations, especially if control of the internet and freedom of expression. And mm-hmm, one of the big differences is the Great Firewall in China.
Right.
That's why Hong Kong is such an advantage. If that turns out to be not as free and open as it was going forward, I think that will have a major impact on the way companies operate.
One of the great factors always with China is China's self-interest. And if you look in terms of Hong Kong and relative freedom, there is sort of, again, if it's a spectrum, a tension between the self-interest of keeping that openness and versus control. How do you see that playing out from the perspective of the authorities in Beijing?
Well, this is really another, I think, an example where politics trumps economics.
Mm.
For years, I think Hong Kong has been tolerated, I suppose, because it truly is an international financial center. Even when I was still running the chamber in Hong Kong, there was a period where Shanghai was going to be the new Asia financial center. And, you know, there's a real misperception, I think, generally speaking, and especially in China, what that really means when you say we have an international financial center. It's not just having a bunch of banks.
Mm-hmm.
There's a whole environment of support for international banking and the big four and accounting firms and legal firms and other kinds of service industries, research activities, and all this that are in support of an international finance center, because international bankers speak a different language from local bankers or even regional ones, because they deal in just a much more compound, complex environment. And they are able to do that because of all these support companies and MNCs, as well as SMEs, small, medium-sized enterprises that can have expertise. People speak multiple languages, travel, know the markets, do the analytics. So to move even to Shenzhen, let alone to Shanghai, which may be an expectation, I think is poorly considered. It's going to be very, very difficult for that to happen. And it won't happen anyway, because if you don't have an open, free and open communications network, and convertibility of currency, in the case of RMB, I don't see much hope for that happening. So to your question, in the next step would be, well, what's next for Hong Kong?
Mm.
I mean, we've got two out of three financial centers under threat right now, with, of course, London being Brexit-focused now. So maybe good news for New York City.
You know, even in terms of initial public offerings in Hong Kong, that those have been drying up relative to what they were. The Asian unit of Anheuser-Busch had something like a $9 billion IPO that they pulled.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think my guess is a lot of those potential investments will stay on hold until we see how things fall out from this whole episode. Whether it be shelved or deep sixed is another question. I think if you're responsible to your board and stakeholders, I mean, it's a good decision to kind of wait and see for a while.
Yeah.
The chances of somebody else snatching it up at this point seem probably weak. So it's a wait and see time, I think, for a lot of people in Hong Kong and outside.
We're talking this morning with Richard Volstek, the president of the East-West Center since 2017, and before that, president of the American Chamber of Commerce in Hong Kong. And also before that, president of the American Chamber of Commerce in Taipei, which is another interesting perspective to look at all of this. And how is Taiwan generally looking at, and the leadership in Taiwan, Tsai Ing-wen looking at Hong Kong?
Well, you know, the one country, two systems formula was initially promulgated by Beijing as a way to bring Hong Kong and Taiwan back to the mother country, right? It never had any sales value in Taiwan, because it's a very different. It was not a British colony. It's a very different historical background, and so that didn't carry much water to begin with. And now with what's happening in Hong Kong, it is even making it very difficult for Tsai Ing-wen's KMT opponent in the next election to say much of anything, because it's you know, closer ties with the mainland. We see what happens in Hong Kong with closer ties.
And that's showed up in the political polling.
It has. It definitely has. There's been a significant shift. So, you know, the real issue for what I'm looking historically at Taiwan, I think they have a real opportunity now with companies that are also reevaluating their operations in China because of rule changing that allows more theft of IP and also restricts their operations as far as market access, and also has a new regulatory environment that really said it's not very cost-effective sometimes for operations. So you look at companies that want to be near China, operating in China, but maybe have some of their operations at least outside. So Hong Kong was one of those destinations. Now Taiwan can be. It should be, actually. But it's interesting that Taiwan and the mainland have somewhat similar market access restrictions. And so the number of American and European firms, for example, in Taiwan is relatively small because of market access. Really a protected environment for a long time. I lobbied when I was there for more opening as a counterbalance to the economic connections with mainland. But it has not really, it's gotten better somewhat in the last two or three years, but not significantly. So here's a real opportunity for Taiwan to, make some major moves on longstanding recommendations on market opening and start welcoming companies to set part of their operations there.
Earlier, you used the word tolerance in reference to Hong Kong. Tsai Ing-wen has talked about the idea of granting amnesty to some protesters in Hong Kong. And the Beijing authorities, don't like that idea. But again, in terms of the tolerance level, how do you see that as a factor?
Well, I think it's hard to know the details on the reasoning behind that, but my guess is that there is a sense of camaraderie, I guess, between what the Taiwan people are facing now. Now Hong Kongers have a chance firsthand to see some issues of the same sort. And so I think those are expressions of support, whether it would be actually eventuate in actual results. It's hard to say at this point. But, Beijing does not have a sense of humor. And so even a hint at some things that go counter to their own narrative has kind of a knee-jerk reaction.
So watching from the United States here, how should folks in the United States, folks in Hawaii, be watching developments in Hong Kong?
Well, certainly, I think it's a harbinger of China's whole Asia orientation. The Belt and Road issues and so forth. They've got a lot of positive press on investment and activities and so forth. And so here they've taken a globally renowned city and doing things that is really bad press. Now, they haven't done anything above,
rolling in the PLA.
Brought in the PLA. It would probably be the People's Armed Police, not the PLA. I mean, it's hard to say. But they're more trained for controlling riots in China, so why not in Hong Kong? But the messages that are being sent about the way Chinese operate, albeit from their perspective domestically, is difficult for, I think, the general narrative. Another problem is October 1st is the 7th anniversary of the founding of the People's Republic, and they would prefer not to have that be an unsullied celebration. And here that's only, 6 weeks away or less, actually 5 weeks away.
And that's a bit of a deadline
sense. And you can't just stop this day before. You've got to have time for the media to move on to other stories, I guess. There's a kind of a deadline, it seems, in the air for some kind of activity. The biggest conundrum to me, and I worked with Carrie Lam when she was chief secretary very well, the chambers met with her on a regular basis, and we did as an American chamber, always struck me as being a very smart politician, open, and a good decision maker. So I'm really baffled at the total intransigence on decision on not just shelving the extradition law, but just pulling it all together, which is one of the first demands made by the demonstrators. Well, why not do it? So you kind of wonder who's really pulling the strings there, because it's really, from my experience, is really not in line with her normal way of operation. But people change, I guess, for one reason or another.
Richard, thanks so much for coming in and sharing some thoughts this morning.
My pleasure. Always good to see you.
Richard Volstack, president of the East-West Center here in Honolulu. We'll be right back.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Hawaii Association of Independent Schools, presenting the 2019 Education Fair, offering meetings with private schools, September 21st on Oahu and 22nd on Maui, hais.us.
I'm Fran Butera from Foodscapes Hawaii. I've been an underwriter for 5 years, and it's been a great relationship. Well, it really does connect me with the kind of people I want to have as clients. By underwriting the programming, I get to connect with your great audience and support the station at the same time. I can't think of a more win-win situation.
Hawaii Public Radio Underwriting. Your message heard here. Learn more at hawaiipublicradio.org.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. In today's backyard quiz, we're remembering a woman who was, for decades, Hawaii's queen of jazz, an artist who inspired generations that followed. She was born in Honolulu in 1934 of Okinawan ancestry and performed regularly from the mid-50s until her death in 1984. She started out in 1955 as an MC at the Oasis nightclub in Honolulu, soon went on to the military circuit as a singer. Her accompanist was pianist and arranger Paul Conrad. Another band leader, Martin Denny, helped her get her first recording contract, an album with Conrad's arrangements of jazz standards like Autumn Leaves, along with a few Hapa Haole numbers, and even a Japanese folk song. That album was 1958's Exotic Dreams, designed to capitalize on the exotica trend that was taken off at the time. She continued to be a popular entertainer and a Waikiki fixture until her passing at the early age of 49. For today's quiz, can you name our mystery songbird? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. First one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Chamber Music Hawaii. Traceable performs music of Lochner, Bach, and Risayer September 9th at Palikū Theater and 16th at Doris Duke Theater. Tickets at chambermusichawaii.org.
As we mentioned earlier this week on the program, this is the first week back in class for the University of Hawaii. One difference from last year concerns the governing board of the university, the Board of Regents. In the last legislative session, lawmakers cut their number by more than 25%. It was a controversial move, although it has not received as much publicity as some other developments at the university. One former regent plans to sue the legislature over the action, which he says is unconstitutional. HPR's Ryan Finity has more in this exclusive story.
The University of Hawaii is governed by a board of regents who are nominated by the governor and confirmed by the state senate. They're unpaid volunteers who have exclusive jurisdiction over the management of the university. Attorney Jeff Portnoy served as a regent for the past 5 years and was hoping to be reappointed this summer, but then state lawmakers reduced the size of the board from 15 to 11.
Well, I think it was a concerted effort on the part of several of the legislators to attack the constitutional autonomy of the University of Hawaii.
The state constitution gives the Board of Regents autonomy to manage the university, but lawmakers retain the right to pass laws of, quote, statewide concern. The board has been the subject of political turf wars in the past. In 2007, Democratic lawmakers overrode a veto from Republican Governor Linda Lingle to increase the Board of Regents from 12 to 15. This year, lawmakers reduced the number of seats on the board and reapportioned the remaining seats by geographic region of the state. Under the new 11-person board, a majority of regents would come from neighbor islands, despite 6 of the 10 University of Hawaii campuses and 80% of the students being located on Oahu. Jeff Portnoy calls that change an unconstitutional overreach and says he plans to sue the state.
I think most legislators had no clue what was going on, but there were a small handful, and I'm prepared to name them in my lawsuit, who I think are the driving force behind this and many other efforts to interfere with the autonomy of the university, and I will be naming them.
The law that reduced the number of regents was not passed as usual legislation. Supporters instead used a technique called gut and replace.
Gut and replace is a policy used by the Hawaii State Legislature to take a bill that's originally introduced in one chamber, and once it starts moving, then it's stripped of its entire contents and replaced by the other chamber.
Sandy Ma is the executive director of the government watchdog group Common Cause Hawaii, which is currently suing the state over gut and replace. East Hawaii Island Senator Kai Kahele wrote a bill to reduce the Board of Regents, but it failed to get support in the House of Representatives. Senators later gutted a different bill and inserted the text of Kahele's original bill. Kahele, who has been a regular critic of the University of Hawaii, declined to comment for this story. But in 2017, Kahele said that he was exasperated when East Hawaii was left without a representative on the Board of Regents for several months. Big Island Video News recorded him speaking at a town hall on university issues later that year.
The University of Hawaii has autonomy. It's constitutionally mandated, right? The legislature is not supposed to micromanage a university. I don't want to micromanage a university unless it's a matter of statewide concern. And then that's when you have a little bit of legislative overreach because now it affects the entire state.
The effort to reshape the Board of Regents had support from another frequent critic of UH. During the 2019 legislative session, State Senator Donna Mercado Kim, who heads the Committee on Higher Education, led a brief effort to eliminate more than 200 faculty and staff positions across the University of Hawaii. She did not respond to requests for comment. Former Regent Jeff Portnoy says he was never given any reason for the downsizing of the board. Whether that new board structure is legal will likely be decided in court. Portnoy says he could file suit as soon as next month. For Hawaii Public Radio, I'm Ryan Finnerty.
And one note on disclosure, Jeff Portnoy does a lot of work in media law, and he has on occasion represented Hawaii Public Radio. Ryan Finnerty now joins us in the studio with a bit more on this story. Ryan, the idea of the legislature weighing in on the Board of Regents, you mentioned this in the piece, it's not by itself something new. It has happened before.
Yeah, that's right, Bill. The Board of Regents has been the subject of political fights in the past. The last time the legislature made a major change to the structure of the board was in 2007. The state Democratic Party had a supermajority in both the state House and the state Senate, meaning that they could override vetoes from the governor, who at the time was Republican Linda Lingle. In the 2007 legislative session, lawmakers created this advisory commission to recommend nominees for the governor. But in that same law, they also increased the size of the Board of Regents from 12 to 15. And with this new commission controlling potential nominees, it limited the ability of any one governor to have a big influence on the makeup of the Board of Regents, which is constitutionally responsible for managing UH. So Linda Lingle vetoed that measure, but her veto was overridden and that bill became law. And so that's very different from what happened this year. That's normal checks and balances of the constitutional system, vetoes and overriding vetoes. What happened this year was sort of a subversion of the normal legislative process.
A different change, certainly. Checks and balances, as you point out, a normal part of the system of government. The change in the composition of the board, and again, over time, so it went from 12 up to 15, now it's down to 11. But the way this latest change came about, as you mentioned in the piece, process known as gut and replace. So talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah, gut and replace is a term the state capitol watchers out there have probably heard before. It happens every year. It's this process where lawmakers kind of sneak in provisions to bills that have already been written. Sometimes it's a law they want to get passed that didn't get enough support, and so they'll insert language from their bill that failed into another one. Sometimes there's a complete swap of basically just the bill number and the title stays the same, and that's where the gut comes from, and the language gets completely changed. And so it starts off meaning pertaining to one subject, and maybe by the time it's passed several months later, it's about something completely different, but the number and the title have stayed the same. And that's what's required by the Constitution, is that the title can't change. And so this has actually been, it is currently the subject of a lawsuit by Common Cause Hawaii, who we heard from the executive director, Sandy Ma, in the story. And they sued the state over another law that was passed in 2018 using this gut and replace technique.
The title of the bill was called A Bill for an Act Relating to Public Safety. And it was requiring the Department of Public Safety to prepare an annual report regarding efforts to improve recidivism rates and inmate rehabilitation. So it started off in the Senate, and when it crossed over into the House, it got gutted. And when it got gutted by the House, it got completely changed. But the name of the bill was kept the same, but it became a bill requiring the design of a new state buildings to include hurricane shelter space. So it no longer dealt with recidivism rates and became hurricane shelter space. The basis of this challenge is based on Hawaii state constitutional principles. So our Hawaii state constitution requires that each law shall embrace one subject, and the one subject must be expressed in its title. And also another part of the Hawaii state constitution requires that no bill shall become law unless it passes three readings in the House and three readings in the Senate. And so once it becomes gutted, in our interpretation, in our opinion, is that it hasn't passed three separate readings in each House.
And so, Bill, there's a lot to unpack in there, but basically what happens is a bill gets a number and it gets a title. A lot of times the title's very vague, like pertaining to the University of Hawaii, which could be any number of things. And then that kind of gives lawmakers this ability to change the contents of it. Sometimes the other lawmakers don't even know that it's happened. There are these instances where laws get passed and some people are kind of surprised by what they mean.
And that whole idea, I mean, comes down to for the public and for those of us living here, it's, you know, transparency. Just transparency in government, clear and simple, in terms of what is it that you're planning to do and what is the purpose or intent of that. So heard about the Common Cause lawsuit pending. Also, apparently, we'll be hearing more about the lawsuit with the Board of Regents.
Yeah, that's right. Jeff Portnoy said he could file suit as soon as mid-September. He's not making gut and replace the main thrust of his lawsuit. It's going to be about this constitutional autonomy that the University of Hawaii is supposed to have, but he will be including some gut and replace stuff in that lawsuit, it sounds like. So we have these two cases that involve gut and replace that could potentially change the way that system works.
And we know you'll be watching developments.
I certainly will.
Thanks, Ryan. Ryan Finnerty covers government and public policy for Hawaii Public Radio. You can find his pieces online at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Aloha, I'm Stephen Salaita from Washington, D.C. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Pesticides have been an issue in the islands for a long time, and a series of lawsuits are coming relating to Monsanto and its weed killer Roundup. Stuart Yurton's been following that story for Civil Beat, and he joins us this morning for today's reality check. Good morning, Stuart.
Good morning, Bill.
So these lawsuits could number in the dozens.
Well, that's what the lawyers are saying. We have a couple of lawyers working on this. We talked to them. They filed two suits already, but Michael Green is one of them. He's well known as a trial lawyer in town. He says he has six or seven cases. He has one in federal court now. And another lawyer, a former associate of Michael Green's named Brian McIntosh, has one suit in state court, which is pretty interesting. And McIntosh says he has maybe 35 additional plaintiffs signed up.
And this, as you point out in the piece, Roundup being the issue following this series of decisions in California, really, which have sort of, if not opened the floodgates, certainly led to a number of suits to follow.
That's right. It really has opened the floodgates, Bill. And, you know, as people might know, there was one really huge jury award, $2 billion, which included punitive damages. The judge reduced that to about $87 million in order to follow federal guidelines that limit punitive damages. Another case, $75 million, that got knocked down to $25 million. But still, we're talking about really, really big damages being levied against Monsanto. And really, ultimately, it was parent company Bayer, which bought Monsanto a couple of years ago.
I was going to say that's one change, certainly, in terms of the Monsanto world. Also, with Monsanto's presence in Hawaii, that has been a bit of a moving target as well.
Right. It has a big presence here, as we know. It's one of the big industries here is the seed industry. It's really taken over the place of sugar and pineapple as the top cash crop for Hawaii. And a lot of those seed corn, it's grown by companies like Monsanto that are doing this corn and soybeans that are Roundup resistant. So farmers can spray the fields, get rid of the weeds, and it doesn't kill the crop.
And it's interesting, though, as you point out in your piece, a lot of the lawsuits that you're talking about here don't focus on the operations there that you're talking about in terms of the seed crops, but it's more in terms of I guess the average folks and average gardens or small yards and things.
Right. I mean, these are people who are using it. They might be using it a lot, but yeah, for small operations, either maybe a farm or one of the plaintiffs had a landscaping business and he used Roundup a lot. So yeah, this has really, so far we've seen at least the cases here have nothing to do with the big operations of Monsanto.
And that idea in terms of watching what, because, again, as you lay out, it's a little bit sort of like three-dimensional tic-tac-toe in that you have federal cases, you have state cases as well, and sort of what's going on in Hawaii as part of the picture that's happening on a broader basis nationally.
That's right. So to put it kind of briefly, there's this thing called multi-district litigation, which is complex federal litigation. It's happening in federal courts. It's being managed by the federal courts, and they're deciding which courts hear the cases. First cases were in California. The next cases are going to be in St. Louis near Monsanto's headquarters. So they'll see if they have some kind of home court advantage or what a St. Louis jury does. What's interesting about Brian McIntosh's case is that he managed to keep it in state court using a sort of clever civil procedure maneuver. And that case will be tried in Hawaii probably long before any of the federal cases are tried here.
Interesting point on the timing as well. We will keep an eye on that, and we know that you will too. Thanks, Stuart.
Thanks, Bill.
Stuart Yurton with today's Reality Check. He's a senior business writer for Honolulu Civil Beat. You can find his article on the Monsanto suits at civilbeat.org.
Ray Cruz here, host of Latin Beat. Join me Saturday, September 7th, for a members-only event in HPR's Atherton Studio. It's a Latin jazz concert with Freddie Miranda Jr. and his knockout band, plus a pre-show reception with the artist. For tickets, visit hprtickets.org or call the station during business hours. Sponsored by Amoresco.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we're thinking about a pioneer of Hawaii's jazz scene, a singer whose career began in the late 50s and was especially popular around the Pacific from Hawaii to Hong Kong, Australia, and beyond. She was born in Honolulu in 1934, got her start here in Waikiki nightclubs. During the 1960s, she and pianist Johnny Todd, whom she met and married in Australia, settled in Hawaii for good, raised two children. Her frequent performing partner in those days was singer Jimmy Borges. Her recordings include the album Exotic Dreams, recorded in 1958, and the 1959 album Cool Heat, on which she sings classic American standards like Roger and Hart's Johnny One Note, Jimmy Van Heusen's Like Someone in Love. She did some acting, too. Once in a while, you can catch her on a rerun of the original Hawaii Five-O. Her name? Ethel Azama. Hey, Bruce James in Waipahu knew that. He called right in, and he's today's winner. And if you have a quiz, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
I don't need $1 million to make my dreams come true, baby. All I need is you. All I need is you.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Hawaiian Airlines, celebrating 90 years, offering nonstop service with seat selection to 13 North American cities, now including Boston. Reservations at hawaiianairlines.com.
J.K. Rowling wrote the final chapters of the Harry Potter series in a swanky hotel. She found it was the only place she could focus. Many artists and thinkers use this strategy.
They go somewhere physically isolated and different, where they can, without distraction, think deeply.
Most of us can't retreat to a five-star hotel, but we can do something else, quieting the distractions, this week on Hidden Brain.
Tonight at 7, following Says You.
The Democratic field for the presidential nomination has gotten smaller this week. Hawaii Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard's still in the race, although she won't be on stage for the next debate. But with this focus on the election, there's also a question about security, not for the candidates, but for the ballots. Our contributing editor Neil Milner's here with some thoughts and some research about election security in today's edition of The Long View. And Neil, this certainly is a recurring theme.
Well, not only is it recurring, it's going to be a recurring part of elections from now on for, of course, obviously technical reasons. And the Joint Committee in Congress discovered that all in 2016, there were an attempt to hack all 50 states, some with more success than others. But this is a problem that has become ubiquitous, pervasive, because it's a cat and mouse thing. Hackers find new ways, and we have to find new ways to respond. So part of what you really have to understand, and part of what the Brookings Institution's series on electoral cybersecurity, which is a good source for people to follow, is that you have a continuing problem that you have to work with with a very important organizational characteristic, which, or constitutional characteristic, which is federalism. That one of the fundamental challenges here is, of course, technical, but the other fundamental challenge is that we are in a system that is a federal system. What does that mean concretely? It means this: Congress has the power to set elections, Article 1, Section 4, but administering elections is in the hands of the state. So if you picture that, if you have a pervasive national problem, but you have a system in which 50 states, all of which have this enormous variation with local precincts and all that, have to be the ones to respond to the problem, that's another challenge here, along with whatever the hacker shtick is at any given point in time.
But that really sets up a lot of sort of natural friction in terms of
yeah.
state.
It's called the disconnect, you'll notice. Yeah, friction is, you know, friction requires a kind of rational interaction. Disconnect may mean that you didn't even know very much about it. And the analogy that is frequently used and that Brookings used when they talk about disconnect is 9/11, where you had an enormous wealth of information But there really wasn't, a, you know, prior to it, intelligence information scattered all through bureaucracies.
Right.
And there really wasn't a process by which you could get all this information on time and ergo, to put it simply. That's how 9/11 took place, even though we had information. This is analogous. You had a you have this big problem out there in 2016. The feds tried to communicate some of this information to the states. Now, remember, in some ways, this is even harder because you're going to the places that had autonomy, and this and the disconnects were pretty much amazing. For example, the feds, who have experience with Homeland Security, we're not used to dealing with all these state people who didn't know squat, basically, about a lot of this stuff.
And by the way, a state election commission is not really set up like a law enforcement agency.
No, that's right. And it's not necessarily set up as a kind of technical organization. So here's one of the things that happened. The feds tell the state that there's this hacking going on. The states figure, okay, we're used to that. I mean, it happens all the time. We'll do business as usual to try to keep it out. The feds never said anything to all the states that it was a foreign power trying to do the effect, the thing. So the even simple things like business as usual were interrupted or didn't really get carried out. So much of the thrust here is not just to let, you know, not just to try to figure out how to counter the hackers in a technical sense, but what do you do organizationally to respond? And that's where a lot of the attention is.
You know, one of the interesting points in the research that you highlight there is that, as you said, this is all 50 states. So this is not just, you know, the discussion about electoral college and, oh, look for Ohio and what about Wisconsin. All 50 states.
Plus, you have poll watchers, you have other kinds of people at the precinct level, and some states really rely on the precincts to do a lot of those things. So every one of those things is a challenge, and every one of those things can also be a vulnerability. So what you have going here is a couple of things, one of which is that you attempt to organize some kind of coordination of learning and shared information, and that's where Hawaii comes in. The National Governors Association has given Hawaii plus a few other states an opportunity to participate in a kind of process of doing things to prevent hacking. And it's really a sort of consortium and a way to improve communication. We're talking about maybe six or eight states. And also to figure out what the state of the art is. Now, we know what some of the state of the art should be, that you should have better poll watchers, you should have better, you should have paper ballots as a backup, you should have election audits, you should harden your targets by, let's say, not putting your voter registration list on the internet, which is what the state of Illinois did, and they were hacked, and the possibility then is that you can do all kinds of changing names. We know all that. It's harder to do, and the federal government, Congress, is not interested in doing it. Mitch McConnell won't bring any bill like that forward. So again, it's about national stuff. It's about learning things through shared responsibilities, through coordination, through all of the things that are part of the federal system, all of which sound good and are essential, but you can figure out how difficult a number of those things are.
So it's one thing to learn the lessons. It's another thing to apply the lessons.
Yes, it's another thing to apply the lessons. And one of the things that they're also trying to do is to learn from good people hackers, right? That's another thing you could do. DEF CON, which is a group of hackers who work for the good people, have tried to set up things, and they've set up something called Voter Village, I think is the term. Voter Village is a simulation that goes something like a simulation based on the idea that you've been hacked. What do you do? And that's been a very popular thing to learn. So I think to understand, in short, what's going on here, you have to understand that target hardening is part of this. We know some of the things that are doing. Hawaii has done some of this. Paper ballots, having a paper trail of ballots seems to be essential. But a lot of it is going to depend upon coordinating very diverse people who have mutual interests, but still have to deal with, still are pretty much autonomous from one another.
You know, it's interesting, as Hawaii moves forward to more mail-in balloting and that direction, implications on security for
I mean, there's a couple of implications, I think. One of which is that it reduces the necessity of poll watchers. And poll watchers, precinct workers are hard to find. As things get more technical, there's more to learn. We have trouble getting them there. The other side of it is mail ballots not going to take away the need. Mail ballots... It's still an open question about hackability of mail ballots. You never give up the possibility that something can be hacked, for sure. The important thing is the opportunity for an audit and the opportunity for paper ballots to, you know, something on paper that you can use as a backup.
Yeah. That Brookings site, by the way, very interesting in terms of a lot of news and information on that as well.
Yes, and very readable.
Very readable. Neil Milner. He's a retired professor of political science, contributing editor of our segment, The Long View. Thanks, Neil.
You're welcome.
That is the program for today. Up tomorrow, a little direct democracy, a chance to talk with one of your senators. Join us for a call-in program featuring Senator Mazie Hirono. You'll be able to call and ask questions. The number for that, 941-3689. Meanwhile, you can tell us what's on your mind. Call our talkback line, leave us a comment. You can call that at 808-792-8217. Email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We're on Facebook, The Conversation HPR, and Twitter, at HI Conversation. If you missed any of this show or want a past one, find them on the Conversation page. Links to more information about guests and topics. HPR News and Talk for The Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Bill Dorman. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation. Catherine's back. Aloha.